Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Just one guest today, Jody Dean. Jody Dean, a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York, has been in this show many times, though it's been more than a year since her last appearance, which is way too long. I find her one of the best thinkers on politics around, bringing, among many other things, a sense of the importance of organization, as opposed to the love of structurallessness and spontaneity that is so popular these days, and of the centrality of psychological mechanisms to politics. Yet despite the complexity of the material, Jody always writes and talks with admirable clarity. She was on this show back in October 2013 to discuss her book, The Communist Horizon, also from Verso. In that book, she was trying to reclaim the idea of communism, a word and concept that had been dragged through the mud by both its friends and enemies. In her latest book, Crowds and Party, published earlier this year by Verso, Jody undertakes two related tasks, an analysis of the role of crowds, demonstrations, spectacles, occupations, in politics, which we always have with us, and the need for a revolutionary party, which we don't. Today, and for the last several decades, many on the left celebrate the crowd as politics in itself, the beautiful moment, as she calls it, that doesn't lay the groundwork for a better future, but basically is that future. There are no better examples of this phenomenon than those who claimed during Occupy Wall Street that the gathering itself was the better future and not merely an embryonic event that could lead the way to a seriously transformative organization. Jody isn't shy about calling that organization a party, a rather unfashionable term. She is eloquent in analyzing the reasons for the unfashionability of the party. We're supposed to resist the form as sclerotic and oppressive by its very nature, imposing, among many other things, a uniformity on an endlessly variegated humanity. Now, we're all about multiplicities, movements of movements, and so on. This strikes me, to steal Karl Krauss's comment on psychoanalysis, which, by the way, I don't agree with, as the disease of which it purports to be the cure. This kind of thinking emphasizes difference at the expense of solidarity and guarantees ineffectuality. That ineffectuality might be welcome to those who fear power, but there can be no better world without engaging with and taking power, as daunting and risky as that may sound. Power may corrupt, as Lord Acton said, but powerlessness is no bargain either. As I say in the interview, I shied away from bringing up the psychoanalytic aspects of Jody's argument because I was afraid it might not work well on the radio. But those aspects are quite important, and one of the many reasons you should buy and read this book. That, and her extended critique of the individualism that pervades our society and our minds. Myself included, I'm not sure how well I work with others. That's another angle on the importance of the party organization. Not only is it essential to politics, it's also a way to get us out of our solipsistic little heads. Myself included, I spent a lot of time in my own head and my personal bubble. Enough from me. Here's Jody Dean, author of Crowds and Party, from Verso. Welcome, Jody. You open the book with an anecdote about an event during Occupy Wall Street. There's a chant, "We can take this park," echoed with the people's mic, and it ends with a thudding disappointment. Tell us that story.
This event happened in Washington Square Park, and it was mid-October of Occupy Wall Street. And I opened the book with this because it had a really profound effect on me and my thinking about the movement and my excitement about the movement and my sense of what kind of movement Occupy Wall Street was and could be. The event I described happened about 11 o'clock, between 11 and 12 on a Friday or Saturday night in October. And there was one of the wonderful General Assemblies of over 1,000 people sitting in Washington Square Park in a big circle talking about what their plans were. You know, you probably recall the excitement of that time where it seemed like anything was possible. And so the group had broken into small groups where people would talk with everyone around them. And what they were talking about, or what we were talking about, was whether or not we were going to take the park, which meant, right, were we going to spend the night in the park and try to have a new encampment, just like we had down at Zuccotti Park. And meanwhile, there are police outside of Washington Square Park, right? They've got their vans and the barricades, and they're just kind of standing around. But the park is open till midnight, and so they were just standing around but kind of slowly encircling the General Assembly and slowly closing in to make it clear that if people were not exiting at midnight, they were going to be forcibly removed. So it was there was a threat of police intervention there, though at the time it was still casual. And so the group was discussing, were we going to take the park that night? And there was a people's mic, and people would make their interventions, and everyone was getting excited. You know, we can take this park, and we can take this park tonight, and echoing this. And then a guy gets up, and in my memory or my imagination or the kind of combination thereof, he looks sort of like Russell Brand. And so he's tall and thin with long, groovy hair. And he, you know, he seems like the kind of, imagining himself as a kind of revolutionary. And again, you know, we can take this part, and each person needs to make their own autonomous decision. And the group says, each person needs to make their own autonomous decision. And we can take the part tonight, we can take the part tonight, or we can take it another night, or we can take it another night. Each person decides for her or himself, and on and on. And so what had been this collective idea, like we can do this, starts devolving into what do I want? What is good for me? And then the subsequent speakers all started speaking from what was good for them. What was their perspective? What made sense for them as an individual that night? And then the collective energy and the collective capacity dissipated, right? We had a capacity at the beginning actually to take the park. And then when once each person started deciding for herself what was best for her, our capacity disintegrated and we no longer had it. And so, of course, it became like, well, there were exams at NYU next week and people were really busy and hadn't planned and maybe they needed to do something else. And so it was like put off for another time and everybody ended up going home. And so my concern in the book is to try to capture the combination of collective capacity that we all had together and to try to reclaim that and push that forward against the individualizing tendencies that hurt the movement that night and I think that have hurt the left now for the last 20 or 30 years.
What you talk about here really captures something, a frustration that many of us felt about Occupy, that it was very skeptical about agendas, about structures, about turning this very exhilarating moment into something more permanent and more potentially more transformative. And, you know, as you point out later in the book, this is a lot of readings of the Paris Commune fall into this kind of interpretation that the Commune was itself not a way station to a more permanent, better society, but just the revolutionary life in itself. I mean, isn't this what you're getting at?
Yeah, exactly. So let me talk about that in terms of both things that you mentioned, both the kind of general tendencies on the left as well as the Paris Commune. So with respect to the left, and by the left right now, I mean the kind of Anglo-American European left that understands itself as a left for the last 20 or 30 years and talks about itself as a left. And there's been a shift away from thinking organizationally and strategically in terms of taking power, in terms of a struggle for power, and that has been pushed away in favor of an approach that looks at personal transformation, small group transformation, immediacy, making our immediate relations better. And this making our immediate relations, whether or not they're self relations or small group relations, making those better has been the form of political struggle. And I think it's a form that is ultimately politically damaging, bereft, and the left response to an incorporation into neoliberalism or late capitalism, right? It's not a real form of political struggle. It's only a kind of minor individuated resistance. So I think that this is the problem that we've encountered on the last 20 or 30 years on the left. But it presents itself as somehow an advance, like, well, the problem is power. No, I would say the problem is our lack of power, not power per se, right? If anybody who turns away from power will not have it. So that's the problem on the left. We see this in discussions of the Paris Commune. Like, there's some really excellent discussions out there. Like, for example, Kristen Ross is one of the most wonderful historians and theorists of the Paris Commune, but yet in some of her versions of it, you know, highly influenced by the situationist and by a kind of, I would say, an approach to immediacy or life transformation, she looks at the artistic, aesthetic, immediate effects of the commune, and not the commune as a form of working class power. Instead, it becomes a form of carnival in a way, or immediate freedom in an affective way. And that seems like that has become, for too many on the left, the model of what left struggle should look like. It should look like finding immediate spaces for freedom rather than struggling for power, building institutions of power, forming a counterpower, seizing the state, transforming the economy, overthrowing the elite. Like, the language of overthrowing the ruling class goes away in favor of checking your privilege. Well, those are not the same thing.
Yes, I want to get back to this because this is more like the second half of the book. Let's talk first about the first part of your title, The Crowd. The crowd is a very fascinating thing with an immense political and psychological power. But it's also something that has frightened elites for a long, long time. I mean, you write about Laban and Ortega y Gasset. You could have written about Madison and, the founding fathers. They're all afraid of the mob.
Yeah.
But how are you thinking of the crowd? How is it different from the mob?
That's a great question, because the book is called Crowds and Party, and we've been going into the party part, but I tried to make the argument for the party by associating it with the force of crowds. So I need to explain what I mean by crowds. First, I think of crowds as just the force of many, the very most abstract or formal level. It's the force of many. Now, the many can be mobilized in different ways. Capital and the state often mobilize many. So capital might do it through big stadia, like having concerts or having sporting events, and the state might do it by staging political rallies, or it might do it by amassing armies, or it might do it by permitting parades or something like that. So we have all sorts of official versions of crowds. Once we recognize that crowds are the amassed force of many, then we can see that doesn't tell us much about them politically, right? We don't know if that amassing is a good thing, a bad thing. Is it a form of control? Is it a form of freedom? We don't know. All of that is still kind of blank. I'm interested politically in the force of many that accrues when the many are present in ways that are not authorized by capital or the state. So they come about in an unauthorized fashion, and then they exert a kind of force. Again, at this point, it's still really formal and abstract. It might be a conservative force. It might be an awful force, like a lynch mob. It might be a wonderful progressive force, like refugees pouring across a border, right? I would consider that a progressive force. But we don't know, just by the force of the unauthorized force of many who amass, we don't know if that's a progressive thing or a regressive thing. You don't know. The crowd forces that question. It forces a political question. It doesn't answer it. And so then the politics happen around that forcing. More conservative people usually worry about the force of many, right? They're going to worry about it like, oh, the crowd is going to be out of control, disorderly. Typically, leftists like the force of many, but we also recognize that there are things like lynch mobs.
Or the Republican Convention.
Oh, my God, yeah, right, exactly. Right, the Republican Convention, I think for a lot of us, the tendency, the fact that it seems like they could rupture at any moment into a kind of fascist violent mob is present. Like, we kind of feel that, like what will they do? So this is the question of the crowd, but the crowd doesn't answer it. And so there's left and right tendencies in the crowd, and we fight politically over the meaning of the crowd. And we also try to direct crowd tendencies in some ways, in some directions rather than another. So, for example, if we think about the Egyptian Revolution, leftists wanted to make sure that the working class struggles, the union struggles that had been going on for over 10 years prior to the Egyptian Revolution, were part of understanding that revolution. Liberals wanted to make it much more of these are new young techie people wanting to be part of liberal democracy. Others wanted to make it know it's a force of a particular kind of religious orientation. But all of those are interpretations and arguments about the force of the crowd.
Liberals are deeply fearful, distrustful of crowds. They like individuals in isolation, acting, contemplatively as they head into a voting booth. What is it about liberals that they are, and using that term rather broadly, what is it that they're so afraid of with the crowd?
I think that liberals are so invested in the individual form, right, in the individual as a locus of freedom, that anything that challenges the primacy of the individual is frightening and scary to them. Liberals worry about propaganda, or they worry about imitation. They worry about crowd effects, worry about emotions. It's interesting to try to pull apart liberals and small-D Democrats on that score, because small-D Democrats might favor participatory democracy where a big group, where, you know, it can be done in a face-to-face fashion. Liberals tend to fear that because they want to have private voting, secret voting, so that each individual's decision can be localized and captured in a specific form, right, namely the individual form. And I think they like that because it's a form that's most congenial to capitalism. That's my ideological view.
I'm speaking with Jody Dean, author of Crowds and Party from Verso and professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges.
But the that small D Democrat face to face business, Murray Bookchin, you know, a certain kind of anarchist likes that too. But that's really not practical for a large scale society. Bookchin, for example, didn't want any political unit larger than a municipality because people didn't really know each other beyond that level. I mean, is that in any way practical?
I think you're right to say that the small D Democrats also have an embedded attachment to individuals, and the way they do it is with these small group face-to-face arrangements. It doesn't have to just be the liberal form of isolating voters, that the small D Democrats with their face-to-face relations and everyone who actually knows each other, and you can't have political associations larger than that, they feed into the same kind of phenomenon. I think that that's right. Yes, the small D Democrats, some are going to have the same problems that the liberals do.
And now let's go back to the crowd and the psychology of the crowd. The writings of Le Bon have been very influential on how bourgeois society views the crowd. Tell us about his analysis of the crowd.
There are a few basic things that most people take from Le Bon. Like, one is the primacy of the leader, that the crowd requires a leader. Mussolini loved that about Le Bon. I actually think that when contemporary readers associate Le Bon with the leader, that they should not, that that's a mistake, that we shouldn't follow Mussolini on that, because it actually comes really late in Le Bon's text, like about 8 chapters in, and it's a small part of it. But typically people think of crowd and leader. Freud reinforced this idea that of a relationship between the crowd and leader. But again, I think that that's a mistake, that these people, Mussolini and Freud, were much more worried. They were worried about crowds, and they were trying to find ways to think about the crowds in terms of individuals, and so they brought up the leader. But Le Bon's actually a lot more interesting than that, because he thinks of crowds as provisional, heterogeneous beings. Right? For Le Bon, the crowd is like an entity. It's a being, like an ant swarm, or a cloud, or a wave. And so in the crowd, individuals lose any of their individuating characteristics. Right? The crowd has its own effects, its own dynamics that are not reducible to the preferences of any one individual, right? So it's separate from that. I think that this should be persuasive for us as contemporary people, this idea of a provisional heterogeneous being. We can all point to times when we've been in groups, whether or not, let's say, it's a group of people in a meeting or a group of people in a general assembly, or even maybe a group on Twitter or out in a crowd at a demo, where we can feel the sense of that group. Right? We feel it, even if it's not our own. We can tell what the vibe in the room is. We can tell what the atmosphere of the group is. We can detect feelings and things and feel the weight of those feelings and things, separate from what any individual might think or feel. And so it's that collective dimension, that collective effect back on individual members that Le Bon is bringing up. And so then he talks about various crowd phenomena like imitation, contagion. These are, you know, various sorts of transference effects as a way to get at how groups affect members, how they can have another effect that's inseparable from what any individual thinks.
Now, of course, the underlying fear behind a lot of this from a class point of view is that this crowd is going to unite and chop off the heads of the elites and seize their property.
We could be so lucky.
Getting there is kind of difficult. I mean, the crowd itself may register and foment certain passions, but it's not so good at actually transforming that into a program, is it?
Right, exactly right. So crowds come up against certain limitations. It can't execute things in the future. So a crowd might be able to cross a street or smash something, but it can't carry out activities after it dissipates. So it doesn't have an ability by itself to extend. So these limitations or incapacities of a crowd are where political organizations come in. And I would say as leftists, the question is, how do we take the best aspects of the crowd, right? The energy, the intensity, the sense of collectivity. How do we translate that into a set of capacities that can endure and that can go in some specific directions?
The people who really saw, for example, Occupy, or going further back, the commune as the goal in itself rather than a means to an end. That moment of intensity is just not sustainable, is it? It's just something that is temporary by its very nature.
Yeah, exactly right. Right, it's not. It is temporary by its nature. So these common things that celebrate the poets or the music or the artistic production, I always keep thinking that somebody still was growing the food, somebody was transporting the food, somebody was fixing the food, somebody had built the houses and the roads. Right? There's a whole material basis and material infrastructure that a kind of politics of a beautiful moment omits, right? It erases. And as leftists, we've got to be materialists first and foremost, right? So we can't ignore in our emancipatory enthusiasm for this beautiful moment of rupture, we can't ignore the material basis that has enabled us to do what we're doing. And that's what some of the problems that happen with the celebration of Occupy immediacy or the celebration of the aesthetic rupture of the Paris Commune.
Going back to the Occupy moment, I recall there was this moment where a delegation was going over to Home Depot to get tarps. And I thought, this is made of petroleum, probably produced in the Middle East, you know, manufactured in factories in China, you know, purchased in a big box retail store. Like, how do you get from here to there? It was really a surreal moment.
Yeah, it is. It's completely surreal. Our politics is lacking if we don't have an embedded capacity to reflect on that, address it. The way I would put it is make our setting part of our politics. And Occupy, it seems, in some ways, tried very hard to not talk about, say, everything that was enabling the movement and that started breaking down at that.
Okay, now getting on to the party, or specifically the critiques of the party form. You review some of this history. The great attack on master narratives that began in the 70s and 80s, the attacks on the working class as the revolutionary subject, the Laclau move. What do you trace all that to? Where did it come from?
These problems with the party and these criticisms of the party go back already to the early days of the writing of Marx and Engels. I mean, Marx already encountered criticisms from Bakunin on lines of authoritarianism, on what Bakunin saw as Marx's efforts to insert a kind of political authority over the workers when it was the workers themselves who should make their own decisions. You see already throughout the history of the Second International, problems between what is going to count as few, what's going to count as many, and it shifts back and forth. So there's nothing really brand new about criticisms of the party form. And one of the reasons is that the party is a form that says, I mean, not everybody is in it, right? The party is a limiting form. The problem on the other side is that it says, well, ours is a movement of the working classes. Not all workers are moving, right? Not all the members of the working class favor communism. So the split between party and movement is one that is, it's in a way, it's kind of insurmountable. But I think what we need to do is recognize the strength of the party side of it.
We're listening to an interview with Jody Dean, author of Crowds and Party from Verso, and a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
All your private property is target for your enemy. And your enemy is free.
about some of the dreamy utopianism for the 1960s I mentioned later in the interview with Jody Dean from the Jefferson Airplane. And now part two of my interview with Jody Dean, author of Crowds and Party from Verso and a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York.
Starting in like the 80s with the New Times business out of Britain, the argument that we're living in a whole different form of capitalism, that the old industrial model of workers, proletarians gathered together in dense urban neighborhoods had been broken apart. We're all post-material, post-manufacturing, post-industrial, dispersed and all that. And that made any kind of political unity among the working class impossible. The whole idea of the working class itself was called into question.
The influence of the problems in England that came around with Thatcher has been really strong on the left self-understanding in a broad sense. I think in the U.S., Canada, parts of Europe too, where in England, the problems seem to be less that of capitalism than Margaret Thatcher. And naming Thatcher as the problem then meant that people that, leftists, and this debate was carried out in the Marxist, in the communist publications at the time, like Marxism Today in particular, Marxists felt like, how do we overcome or how do we deal with the problem of Thatcherism? And for many, the answer was going in a more individualist, consumerist, identity-based, less unified, less workerist direction. And so they thought, well, what we need to do is to promise the same kind of freedom, the same kind of individual responsibility, the same kind of individual opportunity that Thatcher is promising. Well, and now in my language, it's like, we'll just have a kind of kinder, gentler Thatcherism, where it will be for citizens. And so they start abandoning the solidaristic working class orientation in favor of reiterating the emphasis on the individual, already part of Thatcher's ideology and part of late capitalism. So you see happening in the 80s a disintegration of working class life under the pressure of capitalism, but also left rhetoric and language, as left rhetoric language, left self-understanding changes, and changes in ways that reflects capitalist ideology.
Now, was this inevitable? I mean, would it have been possible to take a different turn?
Yeah, I actually think it would. I mean, because people like Ellen Mikesens Wood was arguing against this at the time. It was not inevitable that the response to, let's say, the defeat of the miners, that the response is abandoning unions or embracing individualism. There's a lot of blame that can go around, right? The blame can be union elites who are not as responsive to the needs, concerns, and demands of the rank and file. So I think that's possible. I think it could also be place the blame on a kind of left intelligentsia for being too enamored of the benefits of capitalism, and I would probably say at this point, too enthusiastic about technological innovations and technological solutions to everything. So I don't think it was inevitable. I mean, I think at any given historical time, the economic constraints that we're in go in different direction. It's not the case that there's only one option.
But not to mix the language of then and now, Ellen Mikesens Wood's critique of the Marxism Today turn would be subject to what we call the Bernie bro critique now, right? Insensitive to issues of race and gender and sexual preference and all.
Yeah. We on the left have let ourselves be too vulnerable to that critique rather than reminding people, but wait a minute. For example, our union has men and women of different races. Our union already is multiple. You had to have cooperation among different workers in the U.S. even during that period. I mean, it wasn't the case that unions were only white men. So, yes, the leaderships may have been. The left needs to pay more attention to the fact that the rank and file was more diverse. That's important. I think that we have to stop saying that the emphasis on economic egalitarianism does not mean blindness to race and gender. It means that the way to achieve race and gender equality is economic. Right? I mean, women aren't going to be equal if we don't have access to the same positions and the same income. Different races are not going to be equal if they're blocked. So if there's going to be race and gender equality, it has to be economic. So I think that the problem is that somehow the left fell victim to the critique rather than recognizing that we've already been working for those answers. Like, you know, the last chapter of the book, I'm like completely in love with Hosea Hudson, who was an African-American sharecropper living in Birmingham, been a steel worker. And I talk a lot about his memoirs. And what his memoirs make so clear is the way that the Communist Party in the U.S. was committed to struggles in the Black Belt, right? Committed to the national self-determination of African Americans and committed to gender equality. So it's like there's a whole history that somehow got abandoned and lost, and that we on the left, if we don't always recall that, if we don't always bring it up, if we don't always remember, say, the attack on imperialism is a struggle for the rights of multiple ethnic minorities. This Bernie bro criticism acts as if nobody on the left knows this.
Now, the party, of course, is seen in many quarters as an impossibility today. But in your analysis of Holloway's writing, you point out that, you know, he and others say it was once appropriate, but it's no longer appropriate. What happened?
A couple of things about that. The once appropriate, it seems like a very, very weird position. On the one hand, that the language reflects the person's own loss of faith. Like, I used to believe, but now I don't. But it maps this loss of faith, I would say, onto a false reading of history. And the false reading of history says that the party, as in, you know, the good old Bolsheviks and the Communist Party structure, that it fit a very specific form of industrial society, and that it mapped onto this factory model. This is historically an error if we recognize that the most successful communist parties in the world have been in peasant societies, one. Two, if we recognize the rise of communist and socialist parties in cultures and societies where capitalism was not fully established, where industrialization was not fully established, where it was developing and growing. If it were the case that the Communist Party or the party form was only appropriate for industrial societies, its strongest locations would have been England. But it wasn't, right? In England, it didn't occur in this strong form. So there's a real mistake in the reading of history, and a lot of this comes from particular strands of Italian thought, where they map onto a very Italian experience. They make these generalizations about the party form. One other version of this weird history or this weird historical claim regarding it's no longer appropriate for us is there was a time when people said, well, folks join strong parties or they join close-knit parties in order to overcome their alienation. Or people say, no, people join these strong parties because these parties directly reflect the community that they're already part of. They are solve alienation or they don't solve alienation. These are two contradictory points, and both of them are given as reasons for the party. Knowing that lets us see that this false history, this false historical claim, is not appropriate. It doesn't work for us. And so we can't just say, where are we historically? This means the party is right or wrong for us. It means that if we build it, then it will be right for us, and we need to try.
Sort of shy about getting too deeply into the psychoanalysis of the party, but seemed too ambitious for radio. But
yeah, I think it might be too ambitious for all but like four readers.
But there's one aspect of it I thought was very interesting. When I remember when the Soviet Union was collapsing, a lot of people who were not particularly fond of the USSR said, "Oh, phew, now we don't have an albatross around our neck anymore. We can be our own kind of communists and without having Brezhnev around our necks."
Yeah.
That didn't work out that way. You write about how the Soviet Union, for all its many flaws that people would like to list, was an embodiment of some kind of subject who believed.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that the psychological role the Soviet Union played to an international left?
The psychoanalytic framework that informs my work comes from Lacan and Zizek. And what they help us recognize is that the unconscious is not just this blobby mess of sort of sex and violence that we don't know anything about that affects us. Rather, there's a kind of structure to the unconscious. And Freud already has that, right? We know that superego and id are part of the structure of the unconscious. But Lacan and Zizek let us see different figures in the unconscious. And one of these is the subject supposed to believe. And it refers to the way that when we act or go about our daily lives, we are enabled by supposing that there are others around us who believe in things. And we adopt this all the time. You know, like in everyday conversation, people might say, well, you know, everybody says, or everybody thinks, or Republicans believe, or, well, you know, some people believe Obama is a Muslim, or whatever it is. So we use these figures all the time. They structure our thought. And one of the interesting and weird things on the left is that, you know, let's say since 68 at least, there was a huge, massive rejection of communism in parties. There was a great deal of criticism. And you can go back further. You can say, well, Trotskyists were always critical of the Soviet Union. They rejected it, which Trotsky did. Or you can say that, well, after the invasion of Hungary in 56 or after Khrushchev's secret speech or something like that, that people were always critical. And it would be, yes, there were always different breaks and stuff. But then we would still probably come to a rough consensus that in the 60s and 70s, most good leftists were very critical of the Soviet Union. And then you would think that, you know, the Soviet Union was a bad totalitarian country, or it was stagnant and unfree, and dissidents were good guys. And that you would think that if this were true, that once the Soviet Union dissolved, in the early 90s, that then there would be a kind of left flourishing of new possibilities for imagining socialism and communism. And that did not happen. Instead, what happened was this sense of incredible defeat. And this is weird, because if we were already critical of it, why this sense of defeat? My suggestion here is that because the Soviets still functioned for us as the subject supposed to believe, that we really thought that there were some who believed in communism, who believed in some basic sense, who believed in enough of a sense to keep Lenin in his tomb, and enough of a sense to have Red Army parades, and enough of a sense to talk about the triumph of workers and peasant Soviets. We still believed that there was an entity who capable of believing in communism. And once the Soviet Union collapsed, we lost this subject supposed to believe. And that's, you know, has been a kind of trauma for us. I think that what we're starting to see now with the success of Occupy, with the success of the Egyptian revolution at the beginning, with the success of new amassings of the people, is a new set, a new possibility for belief in collective power. And now I think we need to go to the next step, which is building a new kind of party as the embodiment or transmitter of that belief.
I'm speaking with Jody Dean, author of Crowds and Party from Verso and professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges.
So we're in some sort of post-Soviet time now.
Yeah, that's right. I think we're in a post-Soviet time, that we've gone through the loss. Right, so the period of melancholia is over, and now we build something new. And the thing is like I think that this is like real that I'm diagnosing this. Right, so the enthusiasm around Jeremy Corbyn, the enthusiasm around Bernie Sanders, all over Spain. Right, since the movement of the May 15th movement, there've been a flourishing of different parties. Even in Greece, after the capitulation of Syriza, there was still some enthusiasm for that moment that Syriza was able to go beyond what any left party had done in Europe for generations. So I think we are in the post-Soviet time, and one where the left is now pulling itself together again to work towards imagining structures that can endure and that can actually achieve things.
A lot of people would listen sympathetically but say, oh, the party, and, you know, there's the iron law of oligarchy to worry about, that, you know, any kind of structure is going to get immediately repressive, ossified, and the enemy of any kind of liberation. How do we deal with this, the iron law of oligarchy, which has been around for more than a century now?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a, I have a long discussion of the Iron Law of Oligarchy in the book, which really boils down to, this is going to sound terrible, but it really boils down to oligarchy's not that bad. And by that, what I mean is that the term sounds bad, but really what it means is that to carry out different capacities requires some kinds of divisions of labor, and that we can be responsible about those divisions of labor. We don't have to say that the same people who, I don't know, who speak, who raise money, who distribute funds, who go door to door, that all of those people are always the same people. We don't have to say that one is more powerful than another. We don't have to say that each job is for life. We don't have to say that these jobs get paid differently. We don't have to say that each job, that some are more prestigious. We can find institutional ways to deal with the fact of organizational structure. And Iron Law of Oligarchy tries to bewitch us into thinking that a division of labor will only be segmented forever, but it doesn't have to. So that's the first frame, is just to think, wait a minute, we need divisions of labor, but we should just make sure that somebody does one job doesn't mean they get more goodies. Okay, so that's the first part of that. The second part of that is to recognize that sometimes our criticisms of organization are really just our individualist responses to not liking the things that make an organization efficient. So, you know, on the one hand, we might like the fact that an organization exercises a set of decisions for us, but if we disagree with the decision, we might be critical. Well, to be in a group means that you have to let the group make some kinds of decisions. So that we as an individual don't agree with every single thing should not be held up as a sign of the ultimate incapacity of an organization. It should be, rather, understood as that's what an organization does. It does things for the good of the group, not for each individual's own set of preferences. Really, in some ways, our frustration with organization is an effect of the hyper-individualization and hyper-individualism characteristic of contemporary capitalism, where we want everything to meet our every need at all times. I mean, honestly, that's the definition of being an infant, right? That's infantile, to think that we get everything we want whenever we want it.
But even the infant has to learn, never satisfied.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, exactly right, Doug. Right, exactly right. And that's also the good Lacanian point, right, to recognize the constitutive nature of lack, right? This idea of being fully satisfied is itself an illusion and a myth. And this is part of this kind of politics of the beautiful moment that we talked about a little while ago, where, we're all free and artistic and aesthetic and everything is wonderful. I mean, that's a sort of infantile fantasy that we can have a world that's always like that, rather than a world where, in fact, it will sometimes rain and there's climate change and people are mean to each other and, in fact, we have to cook dinner tonight.
Many years ago in this show, Susie Bright said to me, "Workers of the world unite" is an erotic sentiment. And, you know, I was just thinking of that as I was reading the last part of the book about the party as a form of sociable organization. I mean, the life of the American and British communist parties that you write about at the end of the book, where people it was a very lively form of social life. It was not just some ossified, demanding structure, although it could be demanding at times.
Yeah, this is the thing that I really like in the last chapter, and I loved reading these memoirs of British and American communists and their life in the party. And one of my favorites is Vivian Gornick's The Romance of American Communism, because one of the things that she brings out so well is the way that, in fact, it was the kinds of demands that the people, that we communists made on ourselves that made it so enriched. So in a way, it's like the opposite of the beautiful moment of utter freedom. It's like, because I've got to go to this meeting, I've got to sell these papers, I've got to run off these leaflets, I've got to show up to support these picketers. The revolution is what I'm doing. The revolution is on me. It's my responsibility. that's what was so, what made this such an intense life world. Everything had meaning beyond a kind of individual preference, beyond what might make me individually happy. It's like I was fulfilled because my actions are supporting the world revolution. My actions are supporting the global struggle for justice. So in some ways, it's like the shift in the left has been in the direction that would prevent us from having rich, meaningful lives. Instead, it's only kind of, you know, self-indulgent, momentary pleasure rather than the complex, deep, now, you know, erotic ties to world history.
And finally, I asked you this question when we talked about the communist horizon. I'll ask it again in some form. How do we get from here to there?
I mean,
the party seems, you know,
I've got to go, so I'll talk to you later.
On one hand, you know, I was listening to some old 60s music as I was driving up to Montreal, and, you know, it's like we've just lost that capacity for utopian, as silly as it could be sometimes. We've lost the capacity for utopianism on the one hand, but we've also lost the capacity to think about organization. How do we reconstruct these things in this very broken world we live in?
So I think two things, and I want to address both sides of utopian organization. So I think on the one utopian side, exercises in utopian imagining. And in fact, there's another new book that just came out from Frederick Jameson. I think it's called An American Utopia. There's responses from me, Slavoj Žižek, and other people to Jameson's utopian suggestion for the U.S. So that's a site to think about new imaginations. And it came out with Verso. So that's the utopian side. So yes, we need to undertake utopian thinking. The second, organizational side. I think that the political experience of the last, say, 10 to 12 months in the U.S. and U.K. with Corbyn and Sanders has made leftists start to think again about the relationships to the mainstream parties, and that's really useful. In the U.S., the completion of the Sanders presidential campaign has now opened up multiple paths that make us have to raise the question of Jill Stein and the Greens, an independent new socialist party, or working in the Democrats and the multiple local and state elections. And so those are three different paths. They may not necessarily be incompatible, but they might be. I don't have an answer to your question, but I can say that the political experiences that we are all having have now put at least three answers or three possible answers on the table. And that these three answers are not the same as the NGO model, the issue-based politics model, or the identity politics model. That all three suggest a participation in, now I'd say, real political struggle, like the struggle for state power that the left had eschewed for the last 20 or 30 years. So I think that we are getting there, and we're getting there through these engagements and these actions.
Well, and it's also, we've got a younger generation of people rising in the scene for whom, you know, these old debates that have bogged us down for all these decades, this is kind of irrelevant to them.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm hoping, that the younger generation does not seem to be totally worried about the exact characterization of the Soviet Union, that they don't seem completely worried about the exact characterization of splits between socialist and communist, but that they seem very concerned with economic inequality, the lack of a future, climate change, the power of the police, incarceration, and structural racism. And so it strikes me then that the answers that we will find will be those that build a socialism and ultimately a communism that's responsive to our issues, right, to those current problems in the context, right, of U.S. imperialism.
That was Jody Dean, author of Crowds and Party from Verso. I should have asked Jody what she thought of the existing left parties in the interview, but I didn't, so I messaged her and got this answer. Those parties are tremendous resources. They are best when they work together, like we'll see in next week's Socialist Convergence running parallel to the DNC. The Party for Socialism and Liberation, Solidarity, Philly Socialists, Socialist Alternatives, ISO, and others
are coming together to debate what follows the Bernie moment. I see this as a step towards a tighter socialist and communist coalition with the potential for developing into a new party. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a passage from Allen Ginsberg's poem, America, with musical background by Tom Waits. Till next week, bye.
America, how can I write a holy litany in your silly mood? I will continue, like Henry Ford. My strophes are as individual as his automobiles. More so, they're all different sexes. America, I will sell you strophes, 2,500 apiece, 500 down on your old strophes. America, free Tom Mooney. America, save the Spanish loyalists. America, Sacco and Vanzetti must not die. I am the Scottsboro Boys. America, when I was 7, Mama took me to communist cell meetings. They sold us garbanzos, a handful per ticket. A ticket cost a nickel and the speeches were free. Everybody was angelic and sentimental about the workers. It was all so sincere, you have no idea what a good thing the party was. In 1835, Scott Nearing was a grand old man, a real mensch. Mother Bloor made me cry. I once saw Israel Amter playing. Everybody must have been a spy.